That's Hyde Police Headquarters, the center of one of the biggest ever police search operations in this country. Inside now, detectives are studying a police file, which day by day grows in content. And it's collecting evidence which might confirm the killings of young children up on the Pennine Moors about 7 or 8 miles from here.
God love, but it's talking about parole for Mary Lynn. When will I get parole? I am serving a life sentence, Lou. That month's Lou. When will I get my parole? Ah, but this will be with me for the rest of my life and my family.
Finley, who said that she had a sore throat, gave her evidence in a low, husky voice. She said that she had loved Brady and still loved him. When she was cross-examined about her part in the nude photographing session with the child, Leslie Ann Downey, she said, I offer no defense for that. It was indefensible and cruel.
I really can't believe that these people are talking about my Finley. I just can't believe it. They sound as though they're talking about an angel. I had to hear the tapes of my daughter, and I never heard Ian Brady. It was Myra Henley on that tape with my daughter, not Ian Brady. I had to listen to that and identify the body.
Well, it was just one living home all the time, thinking she'd come home, and I was sat with my coat on for about 3 months waiting for daylight to come to run out and see if I could find her.
She said she didn't know that Brady was tape recording the session and that she was ashamed when she heard the tape played later. These were three calculated, cruel and cold-blooded murders, was what Mr. Justice Fenton Atkinson said, and I passed the only sense of law allows.
I was just crying and thinking about what had happened in my mind. And I kept thinking about it, and I couldn't sleep through thinking about it, and it built up and built up, and I think that's what caused it. Be nervous right now.
There was booing from the crowd which had gathered outside.
And I remember my husband saying that Pauline had been found.
On January 2nd, 1938, in Glasgow, Scotland, a young, unmarried waitress by the name of Margaret Peggy Stewart gave birth to a son. She named the child Ian Duncan Stewart. Later, Margaret would claim that her son's true father was a newspaper reporter who had died 3 months before his birth, although this has never been confirmed. Not long after giving birth to the boy, she was forced to put him in the care of Mary and John Sloan, who already had 4 children of their own. Young Ian gelled with the family quickly and even took on their last name, becoming Ian Sloan. And although his mother visited him throughout his childhood, it was apparent from the very start that Ian Sloan was different from other children. Various authors have ascertained that Ian Sloan, who would go down in infamy as Ian Brady, tortured animals during his youth, although this has never been confirmed. Ian, who for the sake of simplicity will be referred to from here on out as Brady, was an extremely intelligent young man who quickly developed an affinity for the outdoors. Around the age of 9, he was accepted into a special school for gifted children called the Shawlands Academy. Once in the school, Brady's behavior began to worsen. He was already known as a dysfunctional, moody child. The Sloan family stated that when Brady would not get his own way, he would throw violent tantrums, oftentimes ending with him slamming his head against the wall repeatedly. This, coupled with his higher-than-average intelligence, and the fact that the local children understood that he was not actually a member of the Sloan family, quickly drove Brady away from seeking outside friends. As one writer put it, Brady saw himself as an outsider, a rebel who was not bound by the same laws as normal people. Ian Brady developed a fascination with Nazi Germany and was known to collect memorabilia from the war from his school chums. Some have stated that this fascination, coupled with his already brooding personality, was a recipe for disaster. There have been various stories of Brady torturing small animals and bullying younger children. While the bullying aspect has been confirmed, as already stated, the torture aspect of his personality has never been confirmed, and Brady himself denied this. Twice during his teenage years, Brady was arrested and charged with burglary and housebreaking. He was placed on probation both times. At age 15, Brady left school and began working at a local shipbuilder as a T-boy. This was followed not long after by other menial jobs. Somewhere between the age of 15 and 16, Brady was arrested for burglary yet again. The courts found him incorrigible and decided that Brady needed to leave Glasgow and go live with his mother, Margaret, who had moved to Manchester, UK, and married an Irish laborer by the name of Patrick Brady. In November of 1954, not long before his 17th birthday, Ian Brady left Scotland and traveled to the United Kingdom. Various sources state that although he did not get along with his stepfather and there were oftentimes violent rows within the household, Ian took his stepfather's last name, Brady, as his own. Brady felt isolated and alone in Manchester and began spending the majority of his time inside of his room, reading Nietzsche and the Marquis de Sade. It has been said that from these writings he took his worldview, which simply put is that of survival of the fittest, and that his worldview began to change, becoming bleak. Brady began to champion cruelty and torture towards others. So, with his mind aswirl with visions of violence and torture, Brady began to branch out, collecting more books on sadistic styles of torture and domination. For in Brady's mind, the idea began to appear that the way forward in his life, since no human laws applied to him, was to find people, young women, and force them to do his will. Around this time, Brady began working in a butcher shop. It is thought by many commentators that working at the butcher nurtured his desire to kill and mutilate human beings. Ian Brady began drinking regularly, becoming increasingly violent and erratic when he did so. It was during this period that Brady came to the attention of local law enforcement as he resorted to his thieving ways and was arrested multiple times, including one incident where he was drunk in public. While incarcerated, in addition to his already morbid fantasies, Brady began to fantasize about performing large bank heists and living a larger-than-life but respectable existence. He began pumping the other prisoners that he was incarcerated with for information in order to learn different ways to acquire money. In addition to this, he began to study accounting while locked up. Although after leaving prison, he continued to work menial jobs before settling at Millward's Merchandising in February of 1959, where he worked as a stock clerk. There's little of interest over the next 2 years in Ian Brady's life, save that he continued to foster his feelings of inferiority, grandiosity, and violent bloodshed and domination. In 1961, however, all of that changed. Myra Hindley was hired in January of 1961 as a shorthand typist. Hindley immediately found herself attracted to the dark-haired Irishman. Much to her consternation, however, Brady seemed absolutely disinterested in the young woman. That is, until the Christmas party of 1961, when Brady, uninhibited after a few drinks, asked the young woman to go on a date with him. Myra Hindley was born in Crumpsall on July 23rd, 1942, to Neely and Bob Hindley. She was raised in nearby Gorton, which is an area of Manchester. Hindley's father, Bob, was a raging alcoholic who was known to regularly beat both his wife and child. The family were from a lower working class background, and as a result of this, Hindley was forced to sleep in a small bed next to her parents. In August of 1946, Hindley's sister Maureen was born. And a year later, when she was 5 years old, Myra was sent to live with her grandmother who lived nearby. There are tales of Myra's father, Bob, instilling a fighting heart within his daughter, teaching her how to scrap with other boys. One such tale, told by Myra herself, involves her being 8 years old when another child scratched her face. After running home to tell her father about it, the older man threatened to beat her if she did not go back and stand up for herself. Hindley immediately ran back and found the boy, beating him up and knocking him to the ground numerous times. According to Hindley, she had quote-unquote scored her first victory. In 1957, Hindley was invited by her best friend, a 13-year-old by the name of Michael Higgins, to go swimming with a number of other people at a local reservoir which was no longer in use. Hindley decided instead to go swimming elsewhere. Unbeknownst to her, Michael drowned swimming in the reservoir, and Hindley would take the blame upon herself after this, as she herself was an extremely good swimmer and felt responsible for his death. At Michael's funeral, Hindley presented the family with a wreath which she had gone out and raised money for. Somewhere during this period of time, Hindley, who had been baptized Roman Catholic at birth, began to dive into her faith, eventually becoming confirmed in 1958. After leaving school, she worked a number of menial jobs, starting first at a local engineering firm. Co-workers stated that Hindley was very well liked at every place that she worked. It's apparent that she had a fairly outgoing personality. By age 17, she was engaged for the first time, although this was eventually called off. It has also been stated that around the age of 17, Hindley began practicing judo, although she found it difficult to find sparring partners, as it was claimed that Hindley was slow to release her grip on the individual she was fighting with. When 18-year-old Hindley began working at Millwards, she dated a number of men, but as already stated, she became infatuated with Brady, despite learning that he had a criminal record. Personal opinion is that Hindley was looking for a bad boy type, and that learning that Brady had a criminal record is more likely than not a contributing factor to her infatuation with him. She was so enthralled by the young man that Hindley began keeping a diary, in which she detailed her growing feelings toward him, feelings which were not initially reciprocated. According to Hindley, their first date was to an X-rated movie, after which they went back to her home and drank wine while reading books on Nazism. She further stated that their relationship developed along this pattern over the course of the next few years, with them going to the cinema, watching a dodgy film, going back to her parents where they would drink and read, and that at work, the two of them would read from literature
detailing the atrocities of the Third Reich. Hindley consciously began to take on the airs of Aryan perfection, dyeing her dark hair blonde and applying bright red lipstick to her lips in order to further appeal to Brady. She did, however, note that there were several characteristics of Brady that were unpleasant. He was exceedingly narcissistic. And she even wrote to a friend at one point claiming that he had drugged her, while speaking of how infatuated she was with the man. That is one of the interesting aspects of this particular case. Hindley was absolutely enthralled to Brady, reaching a point where she would do whatever he said, as well as believe whatever it was that he had believed. In a letter written in the late 1970s, Hindley stated, "Within months, he had convinced me that there was no God at all. He could have told me that the earth was flat, the moon was made of green cheese, and the sun rose in the west. I would have believed him. Such was his power of persuasion." In addition to taking on the beliefs of her lover, Hindley also began to dress as he liked, wearing high boots, short skirts, and leather jackets. Colleagues noted that the two of them began to withdraw themselves from social engagements, preferring to spend the majority of their time together, alone. It was during these sessions, when they were by themselves, that Hindley and Brady began to discuss their fantasies, was of robbing banks and grand heists. In fact, Hindley, who had no driver's license, went so far as to rent vans on at least three occasions, from which they sat and watched the banks that they planned to rob, although these fantasies never came to fruition. There were other, darker fantasies that Brady shared with Hindley, however. His ideas of rape and torture, murder. Hindley does not appear to have been offended by these ideas. In fact, as noted earlier, she was known as something of a tough girl who took great pleasure in restraining the individuals that she was practicing judo with. It was during this period that Myra Hindley befriended a man by the name of George Clitheroe, who was the president of a local rifle club. She began going to local shooting ranges, and through Clitheroe was able to purchase a .22 rifle from a merchant in Manchester. Hindley began to express an interest in handguns, although it was quickly decided that she was an unstable, dangerous marksman with the gun. Hindley was able to persuade other members of the gun club, however, to sell her two handguns, a Webley 45 caliber and a Smith & Wesson 38. Brady, aware of what his girlfriend was doing, began to show an active interest in photography. He already had one camera, but soon he began to expand on his collection, buying much more expensive and sophisticated equipment, as well as darkroom technology. Hindley later noted that as their relationship progressed and Brady's interest in photography bloomed, he became more demanding of her, oftentimes forcing her to take explicit photographs, which Hindley was initially reluctant to do. She eventually relented, fearing that if she did not, Brady would leave her, and thus her infatuation with him would have been in vain. There are other aspects of Brady's personality that he transferred on to Hindley, including, but not limited to, his desire for sadomasochistic sex, his unhealthy fascination with Nazi ideology, and his hatred of children. It seems all too obvious that Myra Hindley was open to the
ideas that Brady was fostering upon her. In fact, she almost seems to be like a seed for his perversions. Later, Hindley would state that she was forced to participate in what was to come, that Brady had taken explicit photographs of the two of them engaged in sexual acts and used them as blackmail to get her to become complicit in his demands. However, Brady countered this by stating that Hindley was complicit the entire time, and in fact, encouraged his budding fascination with pornographic photography, as well as his desire to seek out and murder children. Investigators who looked into the case later came to the conclusion that Hindley was spinning lies in order to make herself appear more innocent than she actually was, in the hopes that this would gain her some sympathy with both the court and public opinion. On July 12, 1963, he and Brady told Myra Hindley that he wanted to commit the quote-unquote perfect murder. Hindley, who had recently gotten her driver's license, acquiesced to his demands. After work, with Hindley driving their minivan, while Brady drove on his motorcycle, the two of them had worked out a scheme wherein Brady would flash the headlight of the motorcycle to indicate that he had found the victim. Driving down Gordon Lane, Brady flashed his headlight at Hindley, who kept driving, as she recognized the young girl as being a neighbor of her mother. At some point after 7:30 p.m., the couple drove on Froxmer Street, and Brady signaled again to Hindley as he had spied another potential victim. This one, a 16-year-old by the name of Pauline Reedy. Hindley recognized the girl as being a classmate of her younger sister, Maureen. Pauline, who was in the process of going to a local dance, knowing the girl, Hindley was able to coax her over and into the van, after which they drove off into the growing gloom of the night. Over the years, Myra Hindley gave conflicting accounts as to her actual complicity in this particular murder, at some point stating that she actively helped Brady choose the victim as well as dispose of them, while at others stating that she was so fearful of what Brady might do should she refuse his demands, she had simply gone along with it. In any event, as they drove, Pauline and Myra spoke. Pauline confided to Myra Hindley that she was on her way to the dance. Hindley promised to bring her to the dance, but only if the young girl would go with them and help her look for an expensive glove that she had lost over on Saddleworth Moor. When Reedy agreed, they drove out to the moors, with Brady appearing some time later. Initially nervous of the strange man, Myra did her best to convince the young girl that he was a friend of hers and that he would be helping them look for the glove. Myra Hindley later claimed that she sat in the van while the two of them searched the moor for the supposedly lost glove. In any event, once out on Saddleworth Moor, Brady got the young woman alone and then attacked her, brutally raping her before smashing in her skull with a shovel that he had brought along and slashing her throat so viciously that young Pauline was nearly decapitated. Of the two wounds that Brady inflicted upon her throat, it has been stated that the second was the more vicious of the two, and that he had actually ripped through her voice box, forcing the chain that was around the young girl's neck as well as the collar to her overcoat into the wound. According to Hindley, when Brady returned a short time later and retrieved her from the van, He brought her to where Pauline lay dying. Noticing that the young girl's clothing was in disarray, Hindley apparently asked Brady as to whether or not he had raped the young girl, to which she replied, "Of course I did." According to Hindley, at this point, Brady returned to the van to retrieve a shovel that the two of them had hidden there prior to the attack. However, this seems very unlikely, as Brady had already struck the young woman in the head with a spade, which is another word for a type of a shovel. And it's more likely than not that the shovel was already up there, assuming we are, of course, that he actually went back and got Hindley to help with the removal of the body. Again, Hindley claimed that she waited in the van while the attack took place. However, according to Ian Brady, Myra Hindley was an active participant in the assault and murder of Pauline Reedy. Whichever is the reality, the fact remains that both of them were present while Ian Brady buried the young girl. We will return to the Moore's murders in just a moment. It's interesting to note that after the murder of Pauline Reedy, Ian Brady and Myra Hindley went on with their lives as though nothing had happened. If you were to believe Hindley, she had committed this crime against her will, yet there was no notion of contacting the police or letting someone know what her boyfriend had done. Which at least to me paints a picture of a woman who was without conscience and without soul, much as her partner was. The two of them went on a cooling off period after this murder, which is something that is very common with serial killers, during which they spoke about the murder, often reliving it with each other, while continuing on with their various interests. Their next known murder took place on November 23rd, 1963, at a market in Ashton-under-Lyne. Myra and Brady came across a 12-year-old boy by the name of John Kilbride, and they offered the young man a lift home, stating that his mother would be worried if he was out so late, and also apparently promising him a bottle of sherry. There are conflicting reports on this particular murder. Some state that Brady was already in the car when they picked up John Kilbride, with others stating that Brady was in fact waiting at Saddleworth. However, the fact that Brady was in the car is the more accepted of the two stories. According to this narrative, they first told the young man that they had to swing by their apartment to pick up the bottle of sherry, before changing that to, we need to go to Saddleworth Moor to find Myra's missing glove. The other narrative is that Myra herself drove out to the moor with Kilbride in the car, at which point they met up with Ian Brady, and he instructed her to go to a nearby village and wait for him. In any event, Ian Brady took John Kilbride up into the moors and immediately attacked the boy, attempting to slash his throat with a 6-inch serrated blade. When this proved ineffective, Brady strangled the boy with a piece of string before burying him in a shallow grave. What is interesting to note about this particular murder, and in fact the one that follows this, is that Brady and Hindley were not sticking to a specific sex as far as their victims. Most serial killers target either male or females. More often with killer couples, they target the females as the male is the dominant personality within that relationship. And at least to me, it suggests that there is a very real possibility that Myra Hindley was actively engaged in not only the procurement of the victims as well as their, you know, sexual assaults and murders, as Brady is known to have raped some of the boys, but it stands to reason that Hindley herself would more than likely enjoy the act of forcing herself on a young boy. Another thing that needs to be addressed at this point is the fact that the police were being told that these two children had disappeared, but beyond perfunctory investigations, it doesn't seem as though they really went in depth in attempting to locate the two missing children. Even if they had done a thorough investigation in regards to both of these children, it is honestly very unlikely that they would have caught Brady and Hindley at this point, as neither of them owned a vehicle besides Brady's motorcycle, and that the vehicles they used to procure and transport the children were in fact rentals, which makes it much more difficult to track down a suspect, even if somebody had seen something suspicious, because they would not find the vehicle that they were looking for at a suspect's house. Another thing that needs to be taken into account is the fact that in the early 1960s, even up until the mid to late 1970s, the idea of a serial killer, that is an individual that kills again and again and again after a period of cooling off, was really a novelty that mostly appeared in film and literature. Yes, there had been serial killers littered throughout both Great Britain and the world's past, but for the most part, they were thought to be an oddity and not something that was occurring on a regular basis. After the rape and murder of John Kilbride, Hindley and Brady went on another extended cooling off period where, again, they continued with their lives as though nothing had happened. On June 16th, 1964, just 4 days after his birthday, 12-year-old Keith Bennett vanished on his way to his grandmother's house in Longsight. As with their other two victims, Bennett was out around dusk when he encountered the pair, with Hindley, who was driving a mini pickup truck, pulling alongside of him and asking if he would give her a hand loading some boxes into the back of it. Unbeknownst to Bennett, Ian Brady was lying in the bed of the pickup truck. As with the previous murder, there are conflicting accounts of this one, some stating that Ian Brady was not in the truck, but most contemporary scholars on this series of crimes are in agreement that Brady was more likely than not actually in the truck and not waiting at a prearranged destination for Myra Hindley. They drove out to the moors, where once again, under the guise of looking for a missing glove, they were able to get Keith Bennett to accompany them. The death of Bennett is also one of the aspects of this crime that is open to interpretation. According to Hindley, again, she waited in the vehicle while Brady took the boy out onto the moor into a sort of a ravine, at which point he has sexually assaulted the boy before strangling him with a piece of shoelace and burying him. Other accounts have it that Hindley actually stood up on top of the hill and watched as Brady assaulted and murdered the boy before burying him, as Hindley got some form of sexual gratification out of seeing her partner assault and murder people. As already stated, I personally believe that Hindley did get gratification from watching Brady in action, but I also believe that she took part in the murder and assault of Keith Bennett. Now, you would think that the police would begin investigating the crimes that were taking place within this small area within Manchester, but because of the reasons I've already given, as well as the fact that Brady and Hindley were taking their victims from different towns, the police were unable to compare notes, and it wasn't like we had with the Atlanta child murders, which I covered last season on the Deathcast in a 6-part series that you can find wherever it is that you find your favorite podcasts. The police in Manchester in 1963 and 1964 were very loath to join forces and form a task force in an attempt to locate these children. Again, serial killers and killer couples were a novel idea that didn't exist in the mind of law enforcement at that time. Had this taken place 30 or so years later, you had better believe that the police would be all over it. After another cooling off period, Hindley and Brady visited a fair in Ancoats on December 26, 1964. And here we're going to see a divergence in their already established pattern. They noticed a 10-year-old by the name of Leslie Ann Downey, who was at the fair apparently alone. They approached the young girl, who was standing near one of the rides, at which point the couple dropped some of the packages that they were carrying, and as they began to collect them, spoke to the girl and asked her if she would help them pick up the packages and bring them to the car,
as well as go with them to drop the packages off at their home. Again, looking at it from 2021 eyes, this is mind-boggling that a 10-year-old would go with them, but in 1964, there was no such thing as stranger danger. Leslie and Downey agreed to accompany the pair to the car and back to their home, at which point the guise of the bumbling friendly couple was ripped off to reveal the monsters that lay beneath. When they got Downey inside of their home, Brady and Hindley pounced, forcing the girl to undress before gagging her and making her pose for photographs. Again, there are conflicting reports about all this. Hindley swore up and down that she did not have anything to do with this. However, Brady actually audio recorded what happened to Leslie Ann Downey, as well as took pictures of it, which you heard in the trailer to this episode, Leslie's mother talking about what she had seen and heard. Myra Hindley actively and enthusiastically participated in the subsequent abuse that Leslie Ann Downey was forced to undergo. Myra Hindley later claimed that after they had abused this young girl brutally, she went to draw the child a bath. Unbeknownst to her, Brady was preparing to kill the child, and when she returned, unfortunately, she found Leslie Ann Downey strangled to death with a shoelace. The reality, however, is more likely than not that the two of them killed the young girl together, at which point Myra went and drew a bath in order that they could clean the girl's body to remove any evidence. And even that idea, Hindley tried to play it off that it was her motherly instincts that forced her to go and draw the bath for the child, not the, you know, cold, calculating mind of a sadistic killer who was trying to remove any trace of the crimes that they had committed. The next morning, the 27th of December, they loaded Leslie Ann Downey's naked body into the trunk of their car and drove out to Saddleworth Moor, where they buried her in a grave with her clothing at her feet. One thing that is often overlooked in this case is the fact that Brady and Hindley both routinely returned to the moors to take stage photographs on top of or near the graves of their victims. This is a very typical action of serial killers, the returning to spend time with their victims. Some killers, such as Ted Bundy and Gary Ridgway, would in fact go back and engage in necrophilic acts with the bodies of their victims, whereas Brady and Hindley, it appears as though they were content to simply go back and gloat over the fact of what they had done. To the best of our knowledge, it would be almost a year before the couple struck again. And I say that because in later interviews with police, Ian Brady did claim that he had killed a total of 10 people, although he refused to reveal the names of five unknown victims. And while this may be true that he had done it, it could very well be that he was simply trying to build up his reputation and his ego by claiming victims that he had not, in fact, actually killed. Their final crime was a complete departure from everything that had come before. On the night of October 6, 1965, Hindley and Brady drove to the Manchester Central Railway System, where Hindley waited in the car as Ian went inside the station and looked for a victim. After an indeterminate period of time, Brady returned, bringing with him a 17-year-old by the name of Edward Evans, who lived in Ardwick. Brady apparently introduced Hindley to Evans as his sister. Later, Brady would claim that he had explicitly picked up Evans for the purpose of having a sexual encounter with him and Hindley. They drove Evans back to their apartment on Whirlbrook Avenue, where the trio enjoyed a bottle of wine as they sat and talked. During the course of the night, Brady sent Hindley to go fetch her brother-in-law, a young man by the name of David Smith, who had numerous convictions in his path, one of which was causing bodily harm, which he got when he was 11 years old. Now, the Hindley family did not like David Smith for obvious reasons, but what they did not know was that a friendship had budded between Smith and Brady, with Smith falling under Ian Brady's spell just as much as Myra Hindley had. In fact, according to David Smith, he was in awe of Ian Brady. Now, according to Myra Hindley, she did not like the relationship that was building between Smith and Brady, as she felt that it threatened their safety and freedom. She also stated that before the murder of Evans, Brady had told her in no uncertain terms that he and Smith were going to quote-unquote roll a queer, which is a rather cold way of saying that they planned on mugging a homosexual. After fetching her brother-in-law, Myra Hindley returned to their apartment and instructed him to wait outside for the signal, which was the flickering of the outside lights. When the signal came, David Smith knocked on the door and was greeted by Brady, who asked if he had come to inquire about the quote-unquote miniature wine bottles. After Smith was inside the house, Hindley went into the kitchen to feed the couple's dogs, and while she was in there, according to her own statements, she heard the sounds of a struggle coming from the living room. Looking out, she saw David Smith standing by the door, apparently dumbstruck, at which point Hindley instructed Smith to, quote-unquote, don't stand there, go and help him. Smith went to help Brady and found the older man in the process of smashing in Edward Evans' head with the flat side of an axe, that is to say, from the side, not the back end where it's dull, but the actual side of it, not the blade. At which point, Brady grabbed an electrical cord and proceeded to strangle Edward Evans to death. The body of Edward Evans, however, would prove to be the downfall of Hindley and Brady. Ian Brady had such a terrific struggle trying to subdue Edwards that he had actually suffered a sprained ankle during the assault. Smith was unable to move the body on his own, and after talking for a few minutes, it was decided that they would wrap Edwards' body in plastic sheeting and simply move it into the spare bedroom. After moving the body, Brady and Smith decided that Smith would return the following evening and help move the body of Edwards to the morgue. Returning home that evening, however, David Smith decided to awaken his sleeping wife, Maureen, who, if you'll remember, was Myra's younger sister, and he proceeded to tell Maureen what it was that he had seen.
approximately 3 hours after telling his wife what had happened at Myra and Ian's apartment, the husband and wife made their way down to a local phone booth. To tell you the amount of fear that Smith had for Ian Brady, he armed himself with a screwdriver and a kitchen knife just in case Brady should appear. On the morning of October 7th, at 6:07 a.m., David Smith put in a phone call to the local police station in nearby Hyde and told the police what he had witnessed. And I'm going to read here a direct quote which I have acquired from Murderpedia. Brady opened the door and he said in a very loud voice for him, "Do you want those miniatures?" I nodded my head and said yes, and he led me into the kitchen and gave me 3 miniature bottles of spirits and said, "Do you want the rest?" When I first walked into the house, the door to the living room was closed. Ian went into the living room and I waited in the kitchen. I waited about a minute or two, then suddenly I heard a hell of a scream. It sounded like a woman, really high pitched. Then the screams carried on, one after another, really loud. Then I heard Myra shout, "David, help him," very loud. When I ran in, I just stood inside the living room and I saw a young lad. He was lying with his head and shoulders on the couch and his legs were on the floor. He was facing upwards. Ian was standing over him, facing him with his legs on either side of the young man's legs. The lad was still screaming. Ian had a hatchet in his hand. He was holding it above his head and he hit the lad on the side of his head with the hatchet. I heard the blow. It was a terrible, hard blow. It sounded horrible. After giving this statement on the phone, both Smith and his wife were picked up by the police and driven to the nearby Hyde police station, where he gave an official statement. Superintendent Bob Talbot of the Stalley Bridge Police Department went to the back door of 60 Myrtle Brook Avenue. Apparently, he went undercover wearing a baker's uniform over his own clothing in an effort to disguise that he was with the police. It's kind of odd that he would go to all this effort, because as soon as Hindley answered the back door, the officer identified himself as being with the police and stated that he wanted to speak with her boyfriend. Upon being led into the living room, Officer Talbot found Brady sitting in a chair, writing a note to his employer stating that he would not be able to be in work that day because of his ankle injury. Talbot told the bemused Brady that he was investigating a quote-unquote an act of violence involving guns. They told the police that there had been no violence in the house the previous evening. However, Officer Talbot insisted upon looking through the house, and upon coming to the upstairs bedroom door and finding it locked, Hindley told Talbot that the key was at work. Upon being informed that they would graciously drive Hindley to work to fetch the key, Brady told Hindley to just get the key and let the officers in. Brady and Hindley sat in the living room while the officers went about searching the room upstairs, where they found the body of Edwards wrapped in plastic. Upon coming back downstairs, Brady was placed into handcuffs on suspicion of murder, and Brady is supposed to have said when he was being led out of the house, "Edward and I got into a hell of a row last night, and the situation got out of hand." Although Myra Hindley was not arrested at this time, she and her dog Puppet insisted on accompanying her boyfriend to the police station. My thought is that she went with them out of fear that Brady would try to pin everything on her.
Hindley was questioned about Edward's death and refused to give any sort of answers beyond stating that the entire situation had been an accident. Myra was released from the police on the condition that she returned the next day to be questioned further. After leaving the police station, Myra went to the place of employment that both she and Ian Brady shared and asked to be dismissed from her position. This is presumably so that she could claim unemployment benefits. It is known, however, that while she was there, she found an envelope containing letters or notes from Ian Brady, which Hindley would later claim she did not open. She also stated that the envelope contained nothing to do with the murders, but in fact had to do with the pair's planned bank robberies, and that she had burned it in an ashtray in order to get rid of the evidence. Personally, I don't believe that. I have a feeling that there very likely could have been photographs or possibly even a map with the location of the bodies inside the envelope. Because she was trying to save her own ass as well as her boyfriend's, Myra simply decided to get rid of it. In any event, Myra Hindley was free for 4 days before the police eventually came and arrested her as an accessory to Edward's death. Back at the police station, Ian Brady readily admitted to having killed Edward Evans, but according to Brady, he had not done it alone. He tried to claim that David Smith had actually participated in the murder with him, and that it had simply been a fight that had gotten out of hand. He further went on to state that Myra Hindley had not had anything to do with the crime and had only done what she had been told to do by both himself and David Smith. Smith, on the other hand, told the police a different story. He claimed that Hindley and Brady had two suitcases full of evidence relating to other murders that the pair had committed, and that they had left it in a left luggage office somewhere in Manchester. British Transport Police began searching in earnest for these two mysterious briefcases, and eventually, on October 15th, they located both of them. On a side note, they actually found the luggage ticket in the back of Myra Hindley's Bible. Inside of these suitcases, they found 9 pornographic photographs of a young girl, as well as a tape recording of this young woman's assault. In this recording, you can hear the young girl, who was identified as Leslie Ann Downey, screaming and pleading for help as Myra Hindley berates and chides the girl. Leslie Ann Downey's mother later listened to this recorded as well as viewed these pictures and identified them as being of her daughter. Upon searching the house that Hindley and Brady had occupied, they found an exercise book with the name John Kilbride written inside of it. This made the police extremely suspicious that possibly the couple had been involved in other murders, which, as you are well aware, they obviously were. Because David Smith had only told the officers about the murder of Leslie Ann Downey, which Brady had told him about. They also found a series of pictures that were taken on Saddleworth Moor. The police, at least 150, were brought out to Saddleworth Moor to comb the area looking for possible locations of bodies. The moors in England are large,
expanses of hilly ground that is fairly marsh-like in consistency. And there is little doubt that the police never would have been able to find anything on them had not one of Hindley and Brady's neighbors, an 11-year-old girl who was friends with the couple, come forward and stated that she had been brought to the moors on numerous occasions with them, and she pinpointed to the police areas that Hindley and Brady liked to favor. On the 16th of October, an arm bone was found sticking out of the peat moss that makes up the top layer of the moors. Initially, the police suspected that this was the body of John Kildare, but upon digging, they discovered that it, in fact, belonged to Leslie Ann Downey. Leslie's mother, who was on the moor during the time of the body's discovery, was not made aware of the fact that the police had found anything until later when they were shown clothing that was found inside of the grave, which Leslie's mother was able to identify as belonging to her daughter. 5 days after the discovery of Leslie Ann Downey, on the opposite side of the road that ran through the moors from where Leslie's body was discovered, the police found the badly decomposed body of John Kilbride. Hindley and Brady, who had been remanded into custody, which means held without bail, were charged with the murder of Leslie Ann Downey on the day that the body of John Kilbride was discovered. On December 6th, Ian Brady was charged with the murder of Edward Evans, John Kilbride, and Leslie Ann Downey, while Myra Hindley was charged with the murders of Edward Evans and Leslie Ann Downey. She was also charged with harboring Ian Brady with the knowledge that he had killed. A little twist to this story is that the photographs that Ian Brady and Myra Hindley had taken on the moors showed Myra's dog Puppet in many of them. And in an attempt to learn the age of the dog, as opposed to asking the couple how old the dog was, they decided to perform a procedure which would check the dog's teeth. This required Puppet to be sedated, and Puppet was unable to recover from the anesthesia that he was given due to an undiagnosed disease. This led Myra Hindley to accuse the police of murdering her dogs, and police later stated that this was one of the few instances that they saw any form of emotional response from her. The trial of Myra Hindley and Ian Brady began on April 19th, 1966. Something interesting out of their trial is that the head prosecutor was eventually found to be in collusion with the News of the World newspaper, who were paying him $1,000 for exclusive rights to his story should the couple be convicted. They were also paying him $20 a week, had put him up in a 5-star hotel, and had paid for a trip to France for both he and his wife. This is the kind of thing that in America, the case would immediately be dismissed, but because it's Britain, it was not. In any event, both Hindley and Brady were charged with the murders of Evans, Downey, and Kilbride. This because the prosecution felt there was enough evidence to implicate Myra in Kilbride's murder. They pleaded not guilty, and both of them were forced to take the stand in their defense. When cross-examined by the prosecution over Evans' death, Brady stated that he hadn't killed Evans, as, according to the pathologist's report, Evan's death had been accelerated by strangulation. He went on to further state, "I hit Evans with the axe. If he died from the axe blow, I killed him." When the tape recording of Leslie Ann Downey was played in court, Hindley admitted that her attitude towards the child was brusque and cruel, but claimed that she had been doing it out of fear of what Ian Brady might do to her had she not played along. In fact, throughout the course of her cross-examination, Myra Hindley repeatedly put herself somewhere else when any specific act was being performed on Leslie Ann Downey. Obviously, both of them were found guilty on all three murders, and it should be noted that when they were found guilty, they were given life sentences, with a later magistrate turning into whole life remands, meaning that they could never be released from prison under any circumstances. In 1985, Ian Brady began corresponding with a reporter, and during the course of this correspondence, Brady went on to claim that he had killed Pauline Reedy and Keith Bennett. When questioned by police about this, Brady denied having told the reporter any of this, although obviously the police didn't believe him as they already suspected both he and Hindley had been responsible for the murders. Keith Bennett's mother took the extraordinary step of actually writing to Myra Hindley and begging and pleading with her to give the location of her son's body. For selfish reasons, Myra Hindley agreed to help the police looking at photographs that were shown to her, which she and Brady had taken, although she claimed she would not be able to recall the exact locations unless she was allowed to visit the morgues, which happened on two occasions, although no bodies were found. Eventually, Myra Hindley confessed to all five of the murders, giving a 17-hour taped confession, which police described as one of the greatest performances they had ever seen, further stating that Hindley had only provided them with enough information that would implicate Brady while keeping herself clear of it. Anytime she spoke of a murder, she was conveniently absent from the actual place where the murder was taking place. When presented with this, Brady initially did not believe that Hindley had turned on him in jail. However, after being presented with facts from the Reedy abduction, Ian Brady became ready to confess on his own accord, although under the condition that he immediately be given the means by which to kill himself. Obviously, the police were not prepared to grant that request. Hindley was brought back to the moors once again to help look for the bodies, although she was unable to recall the location of any of the missing bodies. However, on July 1st, 1987, the body of Pauline Reedy was found 3 feet below the surface and 100 yards from where Leslie Ann Downey's body had been discovered. To this day, the body of their second victim, Keith Bennett, has never been found. Ian Brady bounced in between hospitals, mental hospitals, and prison in the intervening years as he would repeatedly attempt to starve himself to death. On May 15, 2017, he died of restrictive pulmonary disease at the age of 79. Myra Hindley, on the other hand, attempted to gain her freedom numerous times, all of which thankfully failed. At one point,
she ended her relationship somewhere around 1971 or 72 with Ian Brady, as she had begun a relationship with one of her jailers, Patricia Cairns. Cairns attempted to raise public awareness of Hindley's case and that her incarceration was unjust. She also attempted to help Hindley escape from prison, an act which got Cairns 6 years in prison. On November 15, 2002, the 60-year-old Myra Hindley died from bronchial pneumonia. The Moores murders are, without a doubt, the most infamous serial killings to ever have taken place in Great Britain, surpassing even those of Fred and Rose West. For even though Fred and Rose had a much higher number of victims, some of whom were their own children, Myra Hindley and Ian Brady were the first contemporary high-profile serial killers in British history. This has been the Deathcast with your host, best-selling author Ian Totten. The Deathcast is a production of Corpse Creek Publishing. If you enjoyed this show, please consider visiting the official website, corpsecreekpublishing.com. You can sign up for the show's official email list, as well as click on the donate button if you would like to help with the production of this show, or buy the host a cup of coffee. You can also find my work on Amazon. Just search for Ian Totten. Until next week, stay morbid.